the situation here is that these are all things that people don't need them, people want them.
Tea, coffee, and yopon?
Yopon? What is yopon? Are you sure you're not saying youporn?
Hey man, please, it's a family channel. Sorry guys. But yes, yopon is this incredible thing that is you could drink like tea. And these guys are doing some incredible work with it.
For a conversation about yopon, indigenous species, existential discussions, builders, backers, venture capital, and a whole lot more. Stay tuned.
Most tea in America and throughout the world is produced by no more than 8 companies. It's imported over thousands of miles, and we're disrupting that dusty old industry with an American native plant called yopon.
What is yopon, dude?
Dude, yopon is a caffeinated plant species that is indigenous to the American Southeast. And it's really special because it's actually our only caffeinated plant species native to America.
Does the world need another one? We have tea, we have coffee. Do we need yopon?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you go to a coffee shop and you're going to find a direct-to-farm, single-origin coffee, and those markets are exploding.
No matter how quote-unquote successful you become, you're really just one trip up away from losing it all.
You know, tea doesn't have that option, really. I mean, you know, tea is a massively conglomerized industry.
I mean, did we ever need tea to begin with? Like, do we ever need coffee?
We have an opportunity to kind of do what happened with coffee and make that kind of direct, you know, single origin farm relationship type tea that just isn't really available in the market.
The story of how tea got to India is super up. Hi, I'm Brian White.
Hi, I'm Kyle White.
And we're here to turn over and totally disrupt the American tea monopoly.
Brian, are you excited for the recording?
I am so excited, guys.
Doesn't look that way.
I'm sorry, I was like looking at my, Kyle and I work at the same, you know, we work at both of the same places.
Mm-hmm.
And the builders and backers is like Slack crazy. You know, like we have like a billion Slack channels and we have to always monitor them. So that's what I was doing. And I was not super excited about that. Yeah.
You know, Amazon also goes like, Amazon is also very thick on Slack. And there was a day when they were going to fire like a shitload of people. And my friend was just sitting there hoping that, you know, my name doesn't come up.
They would fire you on Slack?
Yeah, like no. So the community would tell everyone that, hey, I was fired.
Oh.
So the whole community was sitting on Slack on that day. It was leaked 2 days earlier that on that day there was going to be like mass firing. And everybody was sitting there, and then people just started posting their dog photos because everyone was so bored that, you know, nobody's been fired yet.
Oh, so they didn't like kick everyone off a Slack channel before they fired them.
No. And everyone was just there, and like there was a whole like conversation thread with dog photo, dog photo, dog photo. Oh, guys, I'm gone. Dog photo, dog photo, dog photo. Guys, I'm gone.
I mean, so what? You work for Amazon, or you still work for them, or you did?
No. I am not working for Amazon. My friend is.
Oh, okay, yeah, because they're just like such a deeply fucking unethical company. I mean, we sell tons of tea on Amazon. And I mean, I get it. Like, I understand why Jeff Bezos is the richest guy in the world or whatever, you know, because it's like he's just taking it from all angles. It's like screws over everyone.
Pretty smart, though.
Yeah, he's pretty smart. I mean, he's got it pegged. He's got it pegged.
Yeah.
It's like we're paying him about 40%+. Not to mention all these fucking fees and stuff. And then he's got all the consumers paying for Prime. He's now what, owning all of the distribution and shipping.
Yeah, they have they're tied up with Rivian, right?
You talk about vertical integration, no? This is ultimate vertical integration. This is from the root to the sky.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, they tied up with Rivian, I think, to get a whole bunch of vehicles and all that, and they have the whole.
I was at the airport the other day. I think I was at JFK or it was either Atlanta. And I saw a whole bunch of Amazon planes. I didn't realize that they had their own planes and everything, but they do.
No, they have their own airport. I think Amazon now has their own Oh no, was that UPS somewhere in the Midwest?
So what happened is that UPS said Amazon...
FedEx has their own airport.
Yeah, UPS told Amazon that we are going to increase the rates. And after that, Amazon just threatened UPS. Did you know what? We'll just buy our own airplanes if you try to increase the rates. And then UPS just completely caved and Amazon still bought their own airplanes.
Baller.
You know, I hear a really crazy story, Brian, that you would appreciate. So we always joke how Orlando, where I live, is like an entrepreneurial shit show. And so Rivian was based here. The founders are from Orlando, and they tried to get a bunch of like, they wanted like $100,000 in credits to like build out their little warehouse, and the county told them no. And so they went to where they're based now. And that's how Orlando lost Rivian. They didn't want to throw $100,000 at it.
Damn, that is so sad.
Yeah, happens here all the time.
Wait, that one part cut out from your car, what was it, about $100,000?
So they wanted $100,000 for their like warehouse in Orlando because they're from here, and the county told them no, but they wanted some incentives, and so they left and went to where they are now, and that's how Orlando lost Rivian.
Wow.
This is sad, man. Pathetic.
Yeah, so the guy who owns it is from Rockledge.
Cheap.
Have either of you driven a Rivian or like been inside a Rivian?
No.
I haven't. I have a friend that has one.
I've seen some reviews and stuff. They work pretty well.
Your friend has a Rivian and you've not been in a Rivian? What are you doing, Kyle?
Yeah, well, so he had one. He actually had a lot of problems. So he got it really early and had a bunch of problems with it and sent it back. And then they fixed it and now it's a lot better. So I don't know. I guess I just haven't really seen it enough. But he got it and it kind of like bricked on him. Like it just had like no, in like a month, it just stopped working. Like it wouldn't start. And so they took it back and fixed it. It had some big electrical issue, but it was a really early, like a really, really early Rivian.
So this was the R1T, the truck.
Yeah, it was the truck. I don't know the model or I don't know anything about them.
Yeah, the truck.
But now he loves it, apparently. So.
What is Yopon, dude?
Dude, Yopon is a caffeinated plant species. It has an ancient history of consumption around among indigenous cultures. It's been consumed for at least 8,000 years, probably longer. And today it's been largely forgotten and neglected in commerce as a consequence of the erasure of indigenous culture. So Kyle and I and some key partners have spent the last 10 plus years rebuilding this ancient industry and trying to bring it back.
Why do you guys care?
Well, there's a lot of reasons why we care. You know, like I think it's a mixed bag.
Can we get like 3 reasons why y'all are concerned? Why do y'all care?
Yeah. That's a really great question. I mean, I think there's so many more than 3 reasons why, but I'll try to pick the 3 top ones. So it started out pretty innocent, you know, like I was maybe 25, Kyle was a teenager, and we stumbled on Yopon, just literally in our backyard, and kind of figured out, you know, through reading about it, that it was the only indigenous plant species that contains caffeine in America. And we were like, wow, this isn't something you can buy, right? Like this is apparently a tea, but it's not available in commerce at all. You couldn't purchase it at all. And this is like 2012. So we thought, well, this stuff must taste like shit. Otherwise, somebody would be doing something with it already. And we found some videos on YouTube of people making the tea. We tried making it ourselves. We forced it on everyone we know. And everybody liked it. You know, people enjoyed it. And we were like, man, we're going to be instantly rich from this. And of course, that did not happen, right? That never happens. It's like, 10-year overnight success. But upon developing this supply chain and building a business around this, we learned a lot of things. And one of the main things we learned was this really incredible story of Yopon's origin amongst indigenous cultures mainly, and then even early Americans after that. And when we figured out that Yopon's absence in the market was a direct consequence of the erasure of indigenous culture. You know, like in America, millions of indigenous people lived in the same place for thousands of years. And within 200 years, they were all gone. They were extirpated from their homeland. They were either killed or displaced. And most of these people did not have a written language, do not have a written language even today. And because of that, when you remove them from where they've always been, one or two generations go by and everybody forgets. So really that's what happened about with Yaupon, is everybody just forgot. Culturally in America, it became de classe, sort of unfashionable, became something for peasants and poor people. And we felt this really deep sense of obligation to bring this plant back to the mainstream where it has always been for millennia in America. And we just feel like it should be back there. So we really care about that. We also really care about environmental issues. So in the US, we're growing tons and tons of crops. You know, we produce way more food than we care to eat. As a consequence, we waste much of it. And we're growing things that are largely non-native monoculture crops. And we believe in an indigenous food system. I mean, in Florida specifically, where we're from, there were roughly 1 million people living on the peninsula for at least 8,000 years, probably longer than that. And they were living a sedentary lifestyle. You know, they didn't farm. They just lived off the land. And there was adequate food that occurred naturally to sustain 1 million people for 8,000 years without having to move around. And today, most of that wisdom is lost. And we really do feel like we can create products from indigenous foods that are not only functional, like, and useful, but also delicious. You know, things that consumers actually want to buy. And Yaupon is proof of that. That, you know, you can plant 2,200 Yaupon trees per acre, and you can create a functional ecosystem. It's not some strip mine, sterile, you know, cotton field that's just got poison and shit all over it. This is something that birds can live in, pollinators can feed off of. It's adding nutrients back into the soil. It's preventing erosion, and it's making people money. So we've come to care a lot about all of those things.
Yeah, and that's really good. You know, the environment part, you know, for me especially, has always been just crazy important, you know, for us to really, you know, essentially, you know, Florida, we have a huge problem with, like, clear-cut farming, right, where everyone just cuts everything down and they make farms out of it. The farms eventually die. They become, you know, cheap drywall houses. And, you know, we really wanted to stop that. And that's something we have a huge problem in our state. You know, Brian and I are both water people, you know, and there's huge algae issues in the ecosystem here where we have, because of nitrogen fixing fertilizers, you know, we have these massive algae blooms and that are kind of killing our ecosystem. And some of that is due to agriculture. A lot of it's due to golf courses. But, you know, Yaupon has this opportunity to really be a clean crop, a profitable crop, and one that's healthy to consume. And, you know, when we kind of did the math on that there's no way we couldn't do it. And, you know, especially in the U.S., tea doesn't grow in the U.S. You know, we have the Charleston tea plantation, you know, a couple little plantations in Mississippi, and, you know, a friend of ours has one in South Carolina. And that's really it, you know. And so there isn't a big play for Americans to grow tea either. So we have an opportunity to kind of do what happened with coffee and make that kind of direct, you know, single origin farm relationship type tea that isn't really available in the market.
Did we ever need tea to begin with? Like, do we ever need coffee? I think that the situation here is that these are all things that people don't need them. People want them. You know, this is a product that's driven by demand. So in the US, for instance, there's a massive demand for tea. As Kyle mentioned, we don't really grow tea in the US. You know, 99% of it is imported. And on average, we're moving that material 8,000 miles to get here. So think about all the carbon expenditure and footprint that's associated with moving 250,000 tons of material across 8,000 miles of ocean. And then when it gets here, you dunk it in hot water for 5 minutes and then you throw it right in the trash. So it's like a really radical example of wasteful consumerism. But I mean, like, you guys are from India, okay? So tea, so much tea comes from India. It's a hugely important industry, right, for you guys. But I mean, the story of how tea got to India is super f***ed up. I mean, if you think about the opium wars in China, basically the British subjugated the entire Indian subcontinent and stole the tea from the Chinese and then just grew their own tea. I mean, it was like a Jeff Bezos scenario. We're just talking about Jeff Bezos gave the finger to UPS, you know, and said, well, you know, you want to raise the rates, we'll buy our own planes. Well, that's what the Chinese tried to do. They tried to UPS the British, and the British Bezos them back, you know, and said, the Chinese only wanted silver in exchange for their tea. They had a global monopoly on tea. Tea originated in China, and it was really only grown there at the time. And the British said, well, we don't want to pay silver for the tea. That's all the Chinese wanted, because they had a huge trade deficit with the Chinese over tea. So the British just gave them the finger, smuggled tea seeds out of the country in map tubes into the Indian subcontinent, started planting their own tea plantations. And then, you know, hundreds of years later, you get to where you are today. But one thing, like Kyle and I always say about the tea industry, is that of course you have like good players and bad players. There's good tea, there's bad tea. There are tea plantations in India and elsewhere that have extremely high labor practices, you know, like are really good entities that treat people very nicely and produce very high quality products. But unfortunately, that's not the majority, that's the exception. And most of the tea that ends up in America is very low quality, and in Europe, by the way. And what we tell consumers there is that if you saw the level of poverty that these people live in that produce this tea for you, you would not accept that for yourself. You know, you wouldn't accept that for your friends. And globally, in the tea industry globally, the average life expectancy of a worker is no more than 55 years. So this is like a question that I think consume, and we'll probably get into this later, right? Like values-based buying. But people are buying products all over the world today because they feel like the product supports something that they care about, something that they feel is important. They're like essentially voting with their credit cards, you know? And we really have a massive appeal to that type of consumer because we can tick all the boxes. Social concerns, done. Environmental concerns, done. Even the Trumpy people who are like, I want made in America, done. We got them all the bases covered. I mean, this is like a nonpartisan tea for modern America and globally throughout the world. This is something that we can all get behind because there's literally no downside to it, you know, unless you're a shitty tea company, and then I don't feel so bad for you.
So, Ryan, we, in fact, spoke, I mean, a couple of things.
Yeah.
So, number one, my family has tea estates in India.
Boom. I offended you already. We're like 5 minutes into this.
No, that's completely fine. We also spoke to another person who has a tea plantation as well. His name is Surya, and they do the orthodox tea, which is the tea that has come from China. In India, we've sort of changed up the tea, and we have two methods of producing the tea.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the orthodox, which you have, you dip it in water and you have it. And then there is this other method, which we call as CTC or cut, tear, curl, which is the tea that most Indians consume, which is with the milk and the sugar and everything like that.
Yeah.
So I think in India also, we found our own little species of tea that has grown from the tea that originally came from China. But going back to a few of the other points that you raised, I think I see a lot of similarities in the indigenous American population and the indigenous like Indian population, or the population that we had in the Indian subcontinent. A lot of the things were passed down from generation to generation, orally, verbally. There was nothing much written. So when you displace something, or when you change something, as you said, a couple of generations later, people have forgotten about it because there is no one to pass on the knowledge. And that is why things get lost very easily. So I think I remember reading in Indian history, at least, like we had these massive universities which were, you know, which had certain stores of like, you know, one manuscript here or there, and they were burnt, or the people or the teachers were driven away. So, you know, a lot of the knowledge just went with them because it was never documented. So I think what you're saying in terms of the indigenous population, and once they're displaced, their culture and their sort of tips and tricks of how to live in unison with the environment is sort of going away.
I'm really glad that we're making this parallel, because one thing I was going to bring up is that America and India are both countries that need to confront a colonial past, right? And we both have a colonial past to confront. And both of those things come with uncomfortable realities. And I do see like a lot of parallels there with, you know, an indigenous population that was, you know, mistreated and subjugated and displaced. And it's a really interesting parallel because, of course, we're, you know, a world away from each other, but so many of the same atrocities, same type of atrocities occurred. And really, interestingly, in the same time period, more or less. And really by the same people, more or less.
I feel America has a lot more immigration. So because of that, there is a lot more cultural diversity per se on an international front. India has very small states, which it is made of. Each state has its own religions, has its own beliefs, its own languages, its own very little communities, which come together and form like a huge brain. And because India, like from top to bottom, has very similar geography, there is like no extremely cold or extremely hot places other than like a desert in the middle of that. Similar plantations, similar beliefs. Food completely changes drastically from north of India to south of India. But the beliefs are passed on. The spices are passed on. For example, turmeric is one very major example in India. We use turmeric for everything. And when you get ill, we'll recommend, you know, put turmeric in milk and have hot milk with turmeric. Or apply it to your wounds. It's an antioxidant. While not using the words antioxidant, they will tell you that it is a magic spice of sorts, you know? So when older generation passes that on to the younger generation in the form of stories or in the form of narratives, you know, they get passed on and the knowledge is retained and we are able to have it within our time as well. So I feel India has been very lucky on that front.
And this, especially this thing about turmeric, is something that is still practiced even today. Today, I think even like I think now turmeric is sort of spreading as a, you know, the turmeric tablets and all that are coming out. But even today, like I catch a cold and the first thing anyone in the family will say is that, listen, get some hot milk, put a like a quarter teaspoon of turmeric, put a little bit of honey and just have it and you will be fine. And it actually like it helps. Is there's like, you know, I'm proof of that. There are people who are having like, you know, putting turmeric in toothpaste, turmeric in like there's turmeric in everything now.
Yeah.
I think this whole turmeric term has just taken over.
Totally.
That's a bit of capitalism mixing with past influences and a little bit of marketing.
Yeah.
All like burnt in together.
A lot of marketing.
I know. We got a hold of it.
I just think, you know, the parallels, I think it's kind of funny, the turmeric thing, like the parallels between Yopan and turmeric are really interesting, you know, to where it's like, it's kind of, they're both kind of these, you know, the Native Americans in the U.S., you know, really kind of looked at Yopan in a similar way. It was kind of this magic, you know, this kind of magical herb that they didn't understand, you know, like how in turmeric, they didn't really understand the antioxidants, you know, in Yopan, they didn't really understand the caffeine, right? And it gave them this like huge energy boost and they really just didn't, they didn't have a name for it, you know, but they thought it was this kind of magical herb. I think it's cool that like in cultures where you see those parallels, you know, to where it, you know, and they typically were onto something. And I've always found that fascinating that, you know, they didn't have, you know, a thousandth of the technology we have today, but they were able to kind of figure this out. And I'm always like just super fascinated by those parallels. And you see it kind of in every culture, you know, and I feel like there's one in every, you know, in kind of every culture in the world like that.
So I think that's one of the downsides of us developing at this pace and the way we're growing. I remember Akhil and I had this conversation when COVID started where he was like, you know, think about the way cancer cells attack the healthy cells in a body and the way cancer cells take over. We humans sort of have a similar trajectory. When we go to any place in the world, we end up taking over in that similar way. So that, you know, it keeps, this conversation is leading me to back to that parallel where we're saying that, you know, where Brian referred to that a million people were living there for 8,000 years without the need to really do much agriculture or anything like that. They were able to survive off the things that the nature provided them with. So, you know, today I think we as human beings are so involved in and so focused on growth. We're sort of forgetting that sustainability aspect. Now, I mean, I guess sustainability is now coming back in some way, but it seems like we left it behind in the middle where we were just like, yeah, let's grow.
You know, in The Matrix, Agent Smith says it the best. And he's like, humans are like...
But this is a virus.
Yeah, he says humans are like a virus, a disease. you guys come in, you use the resources, dry them out, and leave. But I feel like now we've spread so much that we have utilized the entire Earth as a resource, and now we're feeling like, you know what, might as well sustain it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what we're really screwing up is, I think as a collective society, human beings have kind of lost touch with the reality and the fact that we are a part of nature. You know, we're not, we don't exist outside of the natural world. We exist as a part of it. And it's all this symbiotic sort of rhythmic thing that has to function properly or everything falls apart. And I don't think nature or the world or any of the part of the natural order of things considers human beings to be super special. You know, we're just going to destroy the earth for ourselves. And then we're all going to die. And then the earth is going to be fine. You know, it's going to shrug us off like a surface nuisance. And I mean, sure, it'll take like a couple hundred thousand years, but that's not really that much time. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's a blink of an eye for the.
Just going back to COVID again, like those 2-3 months where things were locked down, I think it was 3 months where things were really at a standstill. April, May, and June of 2020. Nature rebounded. You were seeing animals in places that we hadn't seen animals in for years. Suddenly the climate was better. Suddenly, you know, a whole lot of things in the world were better. So imagine in 3 months, if that is the effect with minimal human, like, you know, intervention, we obviously humans were still there and, you know, we were still living. But even by reducing our level of activity down to, you know, just being locked at home, we were able to have such an impact on nature. Imagine what eradicating us, how quickly that will change.
Yeah. And think about too, COVID had like, I mean, it was bad. And obviously there was a lot of death and, you know, destruction, but COVID had a pretty low mortality rate globally, you know, as a disease. Think about if it would have been 10% more lethal or 20% more lethal. I mean, the whole fucking world economy would have shut down. Like, it would have all been over. We would have been living like we lived 300, 400 years ago. It would have set us back centuries. So it's very interesting, right? Like, one thing I think Kyle and I have both learned from entrepreneurship is that no matter how quote unquote successful you become, you're really just one trip up away from losing it all. And it doesn't, I mean, even Jeff Bezos is one, you know, fuck up away from losing everything. He probably feels that too, because the more you grow, the higher the stakes are. And there's really no security, you know, it's like an illusion. So you have to embrace the suck. And Kyle and I have seen so many different types of entrepreneurs and ventures and worked with so many of them. And this is something that I have seen as like a universal experience, is that it is just so incredibly difficult. And you're just one slip up away from going all the way back to the bottom.
We kind of saw that during COVID. You know, I think it's really important to like think about, you know, how little moves can actually sometimes really help you, you know. And like, we, you know, we actually did fairly during COVID. We had kind of a unique advantage because, you know, the world was shut down, right? People couldn't get, you know, we were totally vertical. You know, we were growing our own tea, we were processing our own tea. And so a lot of places couldn't get tea. You know, for example, like Starbucks was out of green tea for like 4 months. You know, it was crazy, you know, and you know, but these really big places just had massive supply chain shortages. And, you know, you start to realize, to kind of Brian's point, like how delicate everything was. Now, we were able to pick up some ground on that because, like, you know, these kind of mid-market coffee shops could get the tea they had. So we were able to go in there and fill the holes and retain them, you know. But I think COVID really showed like fragility in our supply chains. If everyone knows that, right? And I'm always curious, like how we're going to recover from, like, how we're going to make sure that never happens again, you know, in terms of supply chain issues. You know, but I think kind of, you know, reshoring certain things like what we're doing, or trying to do, you know, trying to bring a big, you know, commoditized crop back into the U.S., you know, that's good for the environment and keeping it vertical is a really good way to kind of defend against those supply chain issues.
Guys, why is Yopon not a drink in Starbucks? Now that you bring it up, why is it not a drink in Dunkin', and why is it not a drink in the major sector? And how do we get there? How do we get it there if it's not there yet?
We got to plant a shit ton of trees, you know, but essentially it's, you know, we have to, you know, a lot of it is just because we, you know, there's a bunch of companies. There's what, Brian, 10, you have one companies now, 11.
Yeah. Give or take. It's less than a dozen.
You know, we, and something we're really working on is building kind of an industry coalition. You know, the Yaupon space there, you know, all of us, we're all pretty much friends. You don't compete against each other because we do want to see Yaupon at that, you know, at that level at some point. You know, but the issue is that we have to build a supply chain from absolute scratch. You know, I mean, this was, that, you know, when it started, you know, Brian and I were running through the woods and picking this wild plant and, you know, actually got surprisingly far doing that. You know, and now it's to the point where, you know, we have, you know, 80,000 acres under contract, you know, and that we managed to grow Yaupon, and it's still like not really enough to do a Starbucks, you know. And it's crazy, like, how, when you really look at it, like, how much tea we need, and then, like, how do we do that in a way that's not going to affect quality or also move away from our mission to where, like, we don't have people that, you know, we don't want to have people that are not getting paid a living wage, and people, we don't want to grow in a way to where it's bad for the environment, you know. So we have to kind of slow grow, you know, and avoid that want for massive unregulated growth.
You have to think too, like, tea was cultivated by humans for roughly 4,000 years before it became a global commodity. So I'm not, that doesn't help me make a good business case, right? Like, oh, it only took tea 4,000 years to like become the big thing. But the lesson there is that it's not going to happen overnight. You know, we're not trying to build a business. We're trying to build an industry. And that's going to take some time and a lot of resources. And Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, they're really reliant upon that commodity level scale where they're paying like really low prices for huge quantities of material. And the cost and the labor associated with producing Yaupon just doesn't allow any of the current producers to be that cheap. You know, like we can't go to Starbucks and say, yeah, sure, we can match the price you pay for green tea. You know, you can pay $1 a pound or $3 a pound. We're not in the position to do that. And no current Yaupon suppliers are in the position to do that.
My question was more speculative, where Kyle said you guys have 80,000 acres under contract currently. For a Starbucks, what would be the acreage that you would require if we had to just throw a number out in the ballpark?
Yeah, well, that depends, because what we're referring to when we say 80,000 acres is 80,000 acres of wild, unmitigated landscape that contains Yaupon in some way, that we have some sort of management rights or right to cultivate on. But the density of the trees on that property varies. So some acreage is incredibly dense, lots of Yaupon, and some acreage is not so dense. And because these trees are wild, they're not like in neat little hedgerows where they can be harvested mechanically. There's a lot of labor costs associated with harvesting them. So we do have the land. We do have a quantity and a large volume of product, but we do not have the capability of producing it cheaply. Now we are in a position where we're transitioning to an agricultural model, which will allow us to produce a much lower cost, more consistent product that I think would be better aligned for large commercial enterprise. But that's going to take some time. We just now harvested our first farm that we planted about 3 years ago, within the last month. So this is a good time. You know, it's like we're just now coming online with our farming operations. We've planted over 150,000 trees in the last 2 years. And that's going to continue to escalate.
That's really tough. It's really tough to sustain, to plant something 3 years before and then, you know that my rewards are lying 3 years down the line. How do you deal with something like that?
Dude, a tea bush takes 5 years.
See, Vishru, it's even better than tea. Akhil, it's even better than tea. Well, you know, the thing about that is it's a posterity mindset. Like we're accepting of the fact that this business, this industry is in its nascent stages. And we really believe that this is something that's going to make the world better over time for future generations. And I'm not sure that a lot of people in business today, especially American business, care at all about that. I mean, there's very little posterity mindset, especially here in Florida. I mean, the way that we are strip mining the environment in Florida is totally unsustainable. There is no posterity mindset. And that's because, in my opinion, I'm not disparaging the elderly, but the majority of people that live where I live, the average person is like 67 years old. And they're looking at, okay, well, I'm going to be gone in the next 10 to 20 years. So what do I care about the future? You know, I want to have fun. I want to enjoy what's remaining of my life. And I don't care about who comes after. And I hate to say that because I think it's so gross that so many people have that mindset, but it's pretty noticeable. I mean, Kyle, correct me if I'm wrong. Like, Kyle lives in Orlando, which is a younger demographic city, you know, so there's a little bit less of that, but you still see it's very pervasive, especially in Florida, where people really aren't thinking about the future, where I feel like our grandparents, they really didn't have that mindset, right? Like, they wanted to make sure that they were leaving the world a better place than when they found it. And I mean, I'm generalizing, right? But I think it's pretty unfortunate.
Yeah, we can get in the weeds on that. You know, I think it's like, which I don't want to, but, you know, essentially you could look at, I think it's cyclical. You know, it's like when you look at, like, you know, the generation before our parents' generation, you know, were children of the Industrial Revolution, right? And it's like the people in the Industrial Revolution also didn't really give a shit about the future. You know, it was like, it was kind of high growth as fast as you can. And I feel like it's kind of typical. It's like someone, you know, there's that generation that does a lot of growth, and there's that generation that tries to fix the damage from that growth. And I feel like we are now in that cycle of the generation that has to fix that growth, you know, or fix the damages from that growth, you know, and especially in agriculture. You know, it's like we have to figure out, you know, broadly outside of tea, you know, we have to figure out ways to grow food for a rapidly increasing global population, you know, and it's, you know, it's probably one of the biggest challenges facing the future. And it's like, I think, you know, kind of aligning with things that we're doing to where, like, it's such common sense, like, why would we not grow something that is just native here? Like, it's going to grow so easy and so bountiful because it's made to be here, you know? And it's like, can we find foods like that? Can we do things like that? And, you know, why can't we? It's kind of like going back to, you know, early kind of Paleolithic things, but on a more technological scale. You know, why not grow things that grow where they're supposed to grow? And that way you can grow a lot more of it for a lot cheaper and a lot better. You know, but that could be a 6-hour podcast.
Yeah, man, that's a whole other can of worms, because I think it's been the sort of advantage, or sort of, again, I would say positive side effect of COVID, where we've all, speaking of this supply chain issues, we've all sort of started going into, oh yeah, let's see what's native here, what we can make at home, or what's DIY. And I think that way we're focusing our energies on what works here, what works better. So especially with food, the first thing now, everyone's very nutrition, like, you know, conscious. They're all like, yeah, we want something that's high nutrition. Are we getting the right kind of nutrition? All this is really going up. So definitely if something is high in its nutritional value and it grows naturally, it's a no-brainer.
And the change in mindset makes sense though, right? Because the mindset earlier when you started a business was, at least in India, it was that I'll start a business for the next generation and the generation after that and the generation after that. I'll build something that will run for like a century. That's the kind of business I would like to build. That was like the ideal business scenario, like a legacy. And now the discussion around business has changed. And the discussion is now that I'm going to start something today for an exit in 10 years, 5 years, 2 years, sometimes 1 year. Sometimes I'm just going to build a software and try to sell it off in 6 months. You know, I have an application ready and hopefully Google buys me out. Because the importance to money is a lot more than the importance to the idea, because money has become such a nice transactional way of doing things. Everything has a value to it and I can just get out.
But how much of a role do you think that venture capital plays in that mindset?
I am getting to that. So now, let's talk about the other side of both of your lives, right? Let's talk about builders and backers. And let's talk about you guys are working with builders and backers. It is, I'll let you explain what it is, what you guys are doing with it, and why are you guys doing that when you already have a company?
So, I had a very quick, small previous venture capital background down in Orlando, and I really did not like it. I got kind of turned off because we kept investing in the wrong companies, right? To your point, like, we were investing in things that, you know, like, companies like most products nowadays are not built to last. You know, they're built to essentially be sold and have an exit and or get over leveraged by private equity, which I think is as big, if not a bigger problem than misuse of venture capital, you know. And you look at, so with Builders and Backers, we kind of, we met Donna. Actually, Brian was there first, and Brian introduced me to Donna. And, Builders and Backers essentially is an on-ramp to entrepreneurship, right? And, you know, when you think about, who is in entrepreneurial programming and who is building companies, it's mostly people who have some kind of prior knowledge of entrepreneurship, whether it's through a college, through a job, something like that. And it just became this really kind of unequitable model, you know, with venture capital. You know, essentially that last year, think about all the companies that about 7,000 globally got funded by venture capital, which is about 1/1,000th of a percent of the company started. But it's for some reason driving the entire conversation of business. And it's just such a small, it's actually such a small factor in terms of like people who are starting businesses. And it really is a hindrance to ideas that are out there. So Builders and Backers is around the idea stage, right? And on-ramping people to entrepreneurship around their idea and how to test and experiment and get their idea off the sideline, you know? So we have a stat from our internal research that shows that essentially 60% of Americans want to have an idea and 92% of them will act on it, which is about 142 million missing ideas in the business ecosystem. Now, if 1% of those is good, you know, that's a 1.4 million companies that are not, or ideas that aren't getting played on. Good ideas, right? And you have to wonder why that's not happening, you know, and there's research there about venture capital and pitch culture and just a lack of resources, you know? And so Builders and Backers goes in and tries to find people who typically would not participate in an entrepreneurial program but have an idea and don't know where to start. And we try to hold their hand and really get them to that next level to either, you know, hey, venture capital is great for some companies and for a lot of companies it's not, you know, so it's really getting them on that path of, okay, like, where's the next step for you? Is it for venture capital? Are you a Main Street business? You know, are you a Wall Street business? You know, are you looking for, is revenue-based financing great for you? So it's kind of demystifying the entrepreneurial process and also getting people not on this train of like, I got to start a company and I got to go to a venture capital investor and let them run me for the next 10 years. Because a lot of companies aren't built that way.
Yeah, that's true. Those are all really good points. And I kind of got involved with it a little bit before Kyle because running our business, trying to raise capital, I was getting really, really frustrated. And largely, like most entrepreneurs, I did not have like a very comprehensive understanding of how venture capital funds actually work. I do now, but now we have this working knowledge that, wow, you know, VC was never really a good fit for us, and it's actually not a good fit for most startup businesses. And to Kyle's point, it's like if this funding mechanism is not a good fit for so many of the people who are doing startups, then why is it driving the entire conversation around how business culture evolves, not only in America, but throughout the world? And I met Donna Harris a couple of years ago at this event called the Heartland Summit, which takes place in Bentonville, Arkansas. And I watched her pitch about democratizing entrepreneurship. And I just really bought into it. And I think that we're really on to something here because, like, as Kyle mentioned, this is an idea accelerator. It's really meant to take normal people that have great ideas and help them evolve those ideas to test and experiment and validate their ideas to see if they're scalable, if they could be repeatable. You know, is this something that could become a venture that is a good fit for some other sort of investment or injection of capital? And that's really what Builders and Backers does, is it fills the void that is unfortunately more like a gulf, especially in American startup cultures. This is so many people that need to start businesses, that want to, that don't know how to get started, that are intimidated by the pitch culture. They're misled by the media that romanticizes, you know, VC culture, like the whole Shark Tank thing. Most people should not be on Shark Tank. You know, most people should not be pitching to VCs, but that doesn't mean that their ideas are not good. That doesn't mean that they could not have successful ventures. So we're here to help people like that figure out where they go next. And I've been doing it since January. I work, unlike Kyle works in the business development side, I work in the actual accelerator program, and I'm a what's called a builder in residence. And I'm working hand in hand with these businesses. And I have worked with over 150 builders since January. And it's so amazing to see people with no business acumen, no financial knowledge, no access to capital, be totally transformed in their thinking, in their action, in their focus, inside of a 90-day accelerator period with just a $5,000 Pebble grant. It's life-changing for so many people. It really does work. So it's a fun thing to be a part of.
So in fact, I think we were talking to one of our VCs who's associated with us, and they're saying that, you know, a lot of people are starting businesses today just to get funded. They will come with an inkling of an idea and they're like, hey, how can we get this funded? Or they have things just saying like, oh yeah, if we don't get funded, how are we going to come in the news?
Yeah, that's a massive problem. I mean, that people, and unfortunately, it's kind of a two-sided issue, that like, it's like both sides don't want to kind of give on it, you know, to where, you know, VCs have the mandate to deploy capital, right? And sometimes they don't, you know, depending on their ethos and all that stuff, they don't find good fits or whatever. So they just start kind of putting money into anything, or, you know, they'll go to their friends and, you know, try to have them build a company they can fund, or, you know, whatever may happen. But yeah, I mean, you know, and of course there's that scam, you know, the where it's like, I'm going to have this idea, raise tons of money, pull a high monthly salary, and then I'm going to shut that company down in 2 years, and I'm just going to keep doing that the rest of my life, you know, which is a scam that a lot of people will do. Yeah, you know, and that becomes an issue, you know. And then on the other side, it's like, you know, so who do you stop? You know, who stops first? You know, the guy who wants to have the high monthly salary, or the venture capital firm that kind of blindly deploys capital into not well thought out ideas, you know? And yeah, and of course, like, there are good VCs out there, and there's VCs that are good for companies where it's a useful model. You know, but the issue is that people just kind of think that, like, that's what I do. You know, like, I want to go start a, you know, an online craft company, and I need to go have $1 million of venture capital just to tell people I did it, because that's what culturally you're supposed to do now, apparently. And, you know, it's just such a bad deal for everybody. And then you get into private equity, you know, to where it's like, which I think is the bigger problem, you know, where people essentially, you know, you sell your company, the private equity, you know, to the private equity firm, they don't care about anything you're doing. They just leverage it for more debt that they can go use to invest for money. And they just kind of let your company sit in the sidelines, and maybe it makes a profit, maybe it doesn't. Then when it shuts down, they just borrow against the pieces of it, you know, and they keep investing that money. So I think that's a big problem too, you know, is that people just keep selling to PE firms, and these PE firms don't always, now, once again, there's good PE firms too, but they also, a lot of them just don't give a shit about your company.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, to add to that too, it's like, I agree that that occurs, right? Like, that we call it financializing entrepreneurship, where they're a serial founder normally, who like really has a deep understanding of the system, creates a startup that has the growth potential, at least on paper, to appeal to VCs. The VCs put money in, they pay themselves a high monthly, they either flip it, turn it and burn it, or they let it flop and they move on to the next thing. But I also feel like that is such a rare occurrence. You know, it's like, of course VCs will say, oh, this is actually a huge problem, but I'm not convinced that it is. I mean, it happens, right? Like, you have the Adam Newman types that will create a totally, you know, failing business and lose hundreds of millions of dollars of investor capital, and then leave and immediately get funded by fucking VCs again. And it's like, how does this work? How do you look at this historical precedent of a founder who has ripped off so many investors and then immediately give them millions of dollars again?
Even better than that.
Yeah.
I think it's the perception, right? It's the perception that this person, since he built it once and he got it once, he will get it again. And then the first hot potato believing that the next person will also catch the hot potato, who will also toss it to the next person who will be willing to catch it.
The issue is, like, without getting way too into finance, it's like, it's just people, essentially, everything's overvalued right now. So it's like, you know, in WeFunders' case, it was like, or not WeFunders, sorry, in WeWork's case, definitely not WeFunders' case, you know, it was, hey, in our portfolio, we have a company that's worth, you know, $10 billion, right? And, you know, which means the value of the ownership we hold is X amount, and now our fund is worth X amount, when really it's not. And, you know, it's just a way for them to kind of build more money into it. It's just like, it's so much about just creating capital. And it's not about actually like creating value into like products, you know. And it's become such a major issue. And, you know, and I don't know how you really like get out of it, you know. Like I said, like, who, you know, like, it's gonna involve someone to stop taking a check, and you can't expect anyone to stop doing that. You know, it's like that's the hard part with it.
It's not all black and white, though, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's not all black and white.
There are definitely companies who do need money and who do need a lot of capital in order to scale, and that capital cannot come from debt because
they can't get a loan.
The outcome of that money might be 3 years down the line or 4 years down the line. Even as an example, like, you guys are trying to make Yopon a big thing, right? Now, tomorrow you believe that, man, this plant has to kick off and we have to retain the heritage of this particular species of the plant, the tea, right? So then you decide that we are going to go all out, and then you get someone who actually has the capital to supply you and get them on board. They actually have the resources to get you off the ground, get you into Starbucks, get you into XYZ. And you can blast off. So I don't think it's all negative. I feel there is a huge section which actually does very well, tech being one of them, where the development costs are very high.
I mean, if I can interject real quick, like, Akhil, I think what to your point, when you say some companies do need the money, I think our position here in Builders Bank is that most companies need the money. Like, we're not arguing that. It is capital is the lifeblood of a startup business. The real question at hand is, where should they get the money? Like, some things that most founders don't know about VC is that VC dollars, it's the most expensive form of capital that exists. So when you come and you pitch to a VC and they cut you a check, they are looking for a 10 to 20x return on their money within 5 years. And if you can't, at least on paper, produce that return or articulate the story of how you're going to get there, they're not going to be interested in you. But I think that the main problem with VC is that VC is an industry that has come to accept maybe a 90%+ failure rate. You know, they have come to accept that 90%+ of the investments they make will end in failure. And I don't know what other kind of fucking business in the world would ever say, oh, 90% failure rate? That's totally cool with us. I mean, it seems crazy to me. You know, it's a crazy business model. It's really wacky.
Yeah, and I want to definitely, like, you know, make sure the framing is clear, you know, to where, like, what I'm talking about is, like I said way earlier, there's very good VC and PE firms out there. You know, I'm talking about the bad ones, you know, and, you know, Builders of Backers is a VC firm. You know, there's a really good VC firm in Orlando called Gport. There's a lot of good ones that are really thoughtful about who they invest in and really thoughtful in the founders they invest in. There's also a lot that just do it to, like I said, do that, you know, to build that capital. And so it's, you know, I think here, like, we're really talking about the bad ones, you know, the ones that aren't really doing it on a good ethos or a good moral guideline, you know. But there's a lot of them that are, you know,
Let me say that this is obviously, you know, Kyle and I, it's our personal opinion, right? Like, we're not telling you how Builders and Backers feels about things, but this is like our observation, our personal opinion. And I agree with Kyle. I actually think that very few even know VCs are bad. They're not bad. It's just they exist to serve a very small sliver of the market. But the popular conception, the way that the media has led founders to believe, is that, oh, I'm going to have a startup business. I need to find an investor. I need to go to a venture capital firm and I need to pitch to them. And that's not the right path for the overwhelming majority of startup founders. And so this is really not about, oh, VC is terrible. VC exists to serve a very specific type of startup, and that is an extremely high growth venture that can explode and have massive earnings in a very short period of time. And most startup founders are not in the position to deliver on that explosive growth. But our position is that it doesn't mean that they're bad investments. It doesn't mean that they're bad ideas. It doesn't mean that they're businesses that should not exist. So part of what we call our spiky POV at Builders and Backers is that we acknowledge that there's a massive need for alternative capital structures for startup businesses. And then so many of them need more than money, right? Like, I think a lot of found-up starters or investors, what we call builders, including Kyle and I, when we got started, we just thought we needed money, but we didn't really have the business knowledge to know how to spend it efficiently. You know, like, we're like, oh, we need money, but we couldn't tell you, we couldn't articulate a budget for you. We couldn't show you a pro forma that forecasted how we were going to earn revenue over the next 5 years. And I think that founders need to learn how to do those things. They need those very basic business skills. They need mentorship. They need objective feedback.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, it's become like startup, I mean, becoming a founder is a race. And when you started with by forming your company, the finish line is getting funded. There are a lot of success stories and there's a lot of failure. As you said, there's a 90%+ rate of failure. But the thing is that the 5%, 7% that are succeeding in such a way that they are providing for that backing to, you know, back that 90% failure. So in fact, we spoke to Manan, who is from Solar Ladder, who's a solar B2B company based out of India. And he said this more money, more problems line, where he's like, yeah, we've just gotten funded, but we're also a little confused on how to use the funding. So what you're saying, Kyle, about getting funded and not knowing where to put the money, we've noticed this in a few founders that we've spoken to. So, like, you know, we like to ask this question and we're going to ask you this question as well, that today or tomorrow, if you got someone to put $2 million into Yopon Brothers, what would you guys do with it? Or how would you guys deal with it?
We have that dialed down. But you know, there's a, you know, but that's a good point. You know, I think that like that's a question, like that's actually probably one of the differentiating questions that between like a good VC and a bad VC is like, where are you going to put this money and what are you going to do with it? You know, and like make sure, like, you know, throwing $100 million at a bad product is going to make it a bad product. You know, it's not going to help it, you know, but anyway, back to your point, you know, I think like if we had a $2 million investment, you know, it's like, we are, of course, like the biggest thing we need, you know, we want to make sure because that money is expensive, it needs to go into projects that are going to produce more revenue. So we can get off the investment train eventually, right? So it needs to go like to two things. It needs to go to mainly, I mean, there's things in those buckets, but you know, the two main buckets it's going to is supply chain growth, you know, managing our supply chain, then of course building out sales and marketing teams, you know, and getting, you know, and making sure that both of those things have substantial return on investment for both the investor and
right. I mean, we're actually trying to raise money right now, so it's a timely discussion. So because of that, we actually have a very specific use of funds that we can provide that took a lot of thought for a whole team of people to come up with, and a lot of learning about what investors want to get excited about. But also, we're not trying to raise $2 million because we don't think we can get $2 million. And we also don't want to take a bath on evaluation, which is a big problem. Another thing that startup founders don't think about enough is there are landmines all over the place. And having a negative valuation event and then ipso facto a down round afterwards is a really, really big one. So we're trying to raise $750,000 on a safe note which only really gives us a year of runway. And luckily, we're in the position where we do earn a significant amount of revenue. So we basically can run the business off of receivables. And that enables us to take money from investors and use it specifically for growth objectives, which I think is the way to think about it. Investors don't get excited about payroll. They don't get excited about paying off old debt. They get excited about funding things that are going to cause your business to ramp up and scale. And then for us, like, we're not really pitching to venture capitalists. Our business can maybe provide a very good rate of return for an investor, Yopon Brothers. But it's probably not going to give them a 20x return in 5 years. You know, so we're not really doing that. We're pitching mainly to angels, high net worth individuals, philanthropic funds, things of that nature. And that's part of what we do at Builders and Backers too, is we use our experiences from our entrepreneurial lives, Kyle and I at Yopon Brothers for the last 10 years. And really, I joke about it, but it's true. Part of what informs me, at least, is I have made so many friggin' mistakes that I can at least help them avoid making the mistakes that I made, mostly out of ignorance or lack of understanding of where I should go or what I should be doing. That's no longer the case. So now we can go in there and say, you know what, here's how I would think about this. Here's some objective feedback. And our builders really trust that feedback from us because it's truly objective. We're one of the very few accelerators out there, I'm speaking of builders and backers, that we don't take anything from our builders. We don't take any equity. We don't issue any loans. They get $5,000, what we call a non-dilutive pebble grant. They never have to pay it back. It's only to be used for experimentation. So when we talk about use of funds on the business side, it's also really important on the builders and backers side, because we give them a little pebble, a little bit of money, seed funding, whatever you want to call it. And that money has to be used for a very specific purpose, which is taking your idea and experimenting with it in order to help you understand whether or not people want it, right? Do people want this thing that you're selling? And can, if they do, the answer is yes. Can you scale it? Can you make it into a business that's scalable, repeatable, profitable? Those are things we want to know through this process. And I believe the process really does work to serve a much broader swath of entrepreneurship than venture capital or private equity and the current funding mechanisms that are available, including debt. Like, we all know, hey, you want to start a business, you're not going to get a bank loan. Forget it. You know, and friends and family, that's a fucking joke, right? Like, you're not going to get, nobody has, I mean, most of us do not have friends and family that can give us $100,000. So that's one of the things where VCs that are like, you know, try going to friends and family. It's like, okay, well, you know, our dad was a cop. Our mom was a court service, like, assistant. We grew up in a lower middle class household. We had a comfortable life, good childhood. We did not have friends and family that could write a $100,000 check to help us start our business.
Guys, I want one line from each of you. I want to know one thing, the most important thing that is common between Yopon Brothers and that is common between your personal character, and which should be recognizable to me. If I'm talking about Yopon Brothers, I know these people are this way, hence their company is this way. One line from each of you.
And you guys personally, as you guys as people.
You know, I think Yopon Brothers is very people first. That's how I am. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all people. And, you know, I'm someone that, I know it's cool nowadays to say, like, oh, I don't like people, I hate people, whatever. I don't. I'm generally a people person. And I think that, like, when I, you know, help make decisions in the company, it's usually from a people first focus, you know. So, you know, when you look at, like, you know, when we hire new employees, like, it's a big culture thing. You know, we, you know, look at how we're going to pay people to harvest tea. It's like, that's a, make sure we're doing it in a way that they're not being in a, you know, in like a poor wage situation, you know, like that. So everything that I do is typically kind of like people first in mind.
Yeah, I am. I'm markedly less of a people person than Kyle is, but I agree with him to where I think it's really important to employ empathy in everything that you do. You know, treat people the way you want to be treated. And I know that that is an old cliche, but it rings true in basically everything. We call it ethical reciprocity, which is If you can think about that in every transaction, every conversation, it really helps, right? Like we tell our employees this all the time is, if you get a customer that's upset because they got the wrong thing or it was broken or it was bad, well, put yourself in their shoes. Like if you got that wrong thing that you ordered and paid good money for, you might be mad too, you know? And how would you want somebody to speak to you? And then if you make a mistake on the job, put yourself in, you know, at least I can say from the boss's perspective, I put myself in the employee's shoes that I've made mistakes. I continue to make them all the time. So if I were in their position, how would I want my boss to treat me? And I feel that this attitude, even though we are not the best at what we do, you know, we make mistakes all the time. We're very scrappy small business, but we have extremely low turnover. We have very high satisfaction amongst our customers and our employees. We have a customer retention rate over 50%, which is almost unheard of in the industry. And I think the real reason is because our customers, our employees, they really feel like they're part of our family. And that's not an accident. That's an intentional thing. So I definitely would say in business and in life, although I fail at it all the time, it's certainly an intention is to employ that golden rule to everything.
I think putting yourself in other people's shoes is a brilliant way to go about life, because oftentimes we're so consumed with thinking of our own perspective, we don't take out the time to be like, okay, yeah, what is the other guy? What is the person I'm speaking to? Or what is the person I'm confronting feeling like? And speaking of mistakes, I mean, we are human beings at the end of the day. We're not perfect people. We're not robots. We're not machines. We are bound to make mistakes. I think the problem tends to occur when the same mistake repeats itself. There is this line which I have been told ever since I was a kid. He's like, the line is, normal people learn from their own mistakes. Smart people learn from others' mistakes. So, you know, I keep trying to think of that and try to implement that, however unsuccessfully, but it's definitely something that my parents have told me ever since I was, you know, a child. But guys, how does one reach Yopon Brothers? How does one purchase stuff from Yopon Brothers? What's this process?
Sure. Well, of course, you can. We prefer that you go to yoponbrothers.com. That's our website. So buy from us directly if you can. if you must buy from Papa Bezos, feel free. So we're available on Amazon Prime. If you're in Florida, you can find us in all Whole Foods markets. And if you're in the Northeast or the Mid-Atlantic states, you can find us at Mom's Organic Markets. And if you're in Southern California, you can find us at Lassen's. And then we're in Independence all over America and actually throughout the world.
Brian, next time we want to hear that if you're in India, you find us in Reliance stores and you find us in Big Bazaar, which is like the Indian markets.
Can you hook it up,
Kiel? We would love to.
Yeah, we would love to. We can actually try and get you into stores there.
Yeah, we'll eat it up.
I can't even name it. There was like a huge, like kind of supermarket in India we pitched probably a year ago, maybe 2 years ago now. I can't think of the name of it, but we had inroad. What was it?
Spencer's?
I don't know. I'll look at my email, but it was like a fairly big, like supermarket chain in India.
India is very open to experimentation, man. Like you would be amazed how well India treats new drinks.
The thing with India is also that if you look at supermarkets, India is not a very big supermarket kind of nation. We still rely very heavily on local sellers. So every sort of little nook of India has its own chain of supermarkets, which is why when you say a big Indian supermarket, there's no Walmart or Kroger that we can be like, yeah, this is there all over India. Even like Whole Foods for that matter. Like there are a very, very, very small niche of stores, which maybe will have like a store in every big city, or they will appeal to the top 1% of India. So in terms of supermarkets, it's a very, very diverse, sort of ecosystem. Now, I don't know if you guys have heard of Reliance or like the Ambanis at all. They are trying to get in with something called GeoMart, which is something that they're trying to make standardize all over India and get to places that's accessible.
Ambanis are the Bezos of the Indian world.
Bezos, Musk.
Bezos, Musk. Those people.
I'm trying to think of a, you know, family. They're they're the Indian succession, I guess.
Gotcha. Gotcha. They're the Indian version. Well, we would love to be in India for sure. And I think that, you know, Indian consumers would love our products. I mean, we have a Yopan chai that emulates like a traditional masala chai. It's definitely a toned down version to what I think Indians would typically drink, but all the flavors that they would want to see are there. So the cardamom, the clove, the peppercorn, ginger, all that. And we use turmeric all the time too. I actually have turmeric, you know, I'm in Florida, so we're lucky we can grow turmeric here, and I actually have some in my garden.
So one of the major purposes of our podcast is that we wish to connect our founder network with each other. You know how you guys have builders and backers and you wish to build companies. We also hope to get there one day where we can build companies and companies can just come to our podcast. This can be the gateway drug per se. And you guys can explore all the founders that we have. We can connect you to them, take a piece of the trade, whatever is in the middle. But without equity, we guys can help build a lot of businesses. So we hope to get you in all of India. Why not?
Why not? Let's do a builders and backers cohort in India. Kyle's your guy.
Yeah.
So Kyle's the business development director for BNB, and why not? We can do it. We can do one in India.
Yes, absolutely.
We would love to. We would absolutely love to. I think India currently is bubbling with entrepreneurs. I think with Shark Tank coming to India, with a lot of these tech companies coming to India, entrepreneurship is really blossoming here. So I think builders and backers would definitely be a superb addition. And I think we can definitely get that happening for you guys. So just, you know, bringing things to a close, a couple of things I wanted to ask you before that. If you had to list out a couple of like differences between tea and Yopon, is the process of making it the same? What is the thing? Like, what are like two differences between tea and Yopon? And what are two similarities between tea and Yopon? Apart from the caffeine aspect of it all.
Yeah, I would say one major difference is that tea, which we're speaking about Camellia sinensis, which is the tea plant, has a much higher tannin content than Yopon does. So when you drink tea, you detect that little bit of bitterness or astringency. And Yopon very famously does not have that. So some people who drink tea all the time like first perceive Yopon as weak, because it doesn't have that bitterness that they're looking for. But once you drink it more and more and more, you detect actually a complexity of flavor that is so different than tea, but not in a bad way, in a good way. So that's a major difference. I would say similarities are, we've learned a lot from the tea industry. There's a lot of similarities in the way the leaf is processed. Some of our equipment comes from India, actually, originally, and it is not as intensive of a process preparing Yopon leaves as it is preparing tea leaves. There's not as much variation, because you guys probably know this better than most people, but green tea, white tea, black tea, yellow tea, it's all the same plant. It's just a difference in how the plant is harvested, cultivated, processed, etc. So Yopon doesn't really have that variation. It's more straightforward. There are a lot of similarities there.
And in terms of the preparation of the actual tea, is it just the same thing? You just dip it in in hot water?
Yes, it is the same, but Yopon is way less particular about steep time and temperature. So we actually say that Yopon loves heat and time. So with tea, you got to be careful not to steep it too long, you know, steep it too hot. With Yopon, it's take it to boiling, let it cool off a little bit, throw it in there, let it sit for at least 5 minutes, and you're good to go. You want to let it sit longer than 5 minutes? No problem. Doesn't have the tannin, so it's not going to get bitter. So that's another major difference, is the preparation is similar, but not as fussy.
So we like to wrap up. We have this tradition on our podcast where the previous founder has left you guys a question, and we would like you all to answer that question and leave a question for our next founder. We can have one question from each of you. So the question is, if you could change one thing about the entrepreneurial experience in the world today, what would that be? And this is specifically based on the entrepreneurial experience that you guys have had.
Yeah. I can go first if Brian doesn't mind, but I would say being far more open about failure. So much of this, what we have now is like, anytime I go to like an entrepreneurial event or any kind of like ecosystem thing, there's always so many people who just kind of like rattle off their accomplishments. And I think that kind of dilutes the journey in a way. And I think for people who are just getting into entrepreneurship, they, compare themselves to that and don't really understand that everyone fails yet. And that typically, I think, kind of makes them, shy away from actually doing their, doing their idea or doing their company. So I would say being far more open about failure and, just like overall just removing kind of the real like kind of unearned cockiness that happens a lot in entrepreneurship.
Yeah, just a lot of narcissism. I agree with Kyle, and I guess I would say one thing that I would change about it is the performative aspect. There's like this entertainment value where it's very like dance monkey dance and entertain people. And this isn't necessarily about entertaining people. I mean, I think that there is a value in being a good showman and a good salesman, but I don't think that should be a prerequisite for coming out and starting a business. I think we need to have a society and an ecosystem that is inclusive, that is accepting of all people. And when people talk, we listen and we provide feedback objectively. I wish that the ecosystem functioned like that. It really doesn't today. It certainly didn't when we got started. And that would be one thing that I would definitely change is tone down the ego. As Kyle said, be realistic about failure, that the odds are high that you fail. And most successful entrepreneurs have failed several times before they obtain success, but you might not know it from looking at them or speaking to them. I think all of those things are valid. And I would say a question that I would leave